Good afternoon. This is Cross Currents. I'm Kristen Kay. The tension between the U.S. and North Korea has ratcheted up in the past year. Dr. Jeremy Bernstein is a retired theoretical physicist, science essayist, and former writer for The New Yorker. He's also an honorary member of the Board of Trustees for the Aspen Center for Physics. We talked about North Korea's nuclear weapons program, as well as what it was like for him to have one foot in the scientific community and one foot in the literary one. Aspen Public Radio founder and former station manager Cy Coleman joined us in the studio.
One of the elements of the whole North Korean nuclear situation that has my curiosity quite high is that for some years, the U.S. policy on the matter was basically that North Korea was sort of trying to make an atomic bomb. They made a few explosions that didn't really work quite well. But then about 6 or 8 months ago, the U.S. position on it changed radically to the point of saying, oh, they have a deployable weapon that probably can fit on a missile. And it changed overnight without much explanation in between. And I was hoping that maybe there are some scientific reasons that may have been discovered, and maybe Jeremy can give us some insight into that.
Well, I don't think that you have the history quite right, but let me recapitulate a bit of the history. North Korea got into the business of nuclear weapons almost as soon as it was founded. Kim Il-sung, how you pronounce his name, you have to be more of a Korean than I am. His grandfather, who was the first president or whatever they call the office there, wanted nuclear weapons. And his reason is essentially the same as his grandson's, namely to preserve the integrity of the country, which was then just founded. There's been the war, which is still not over. We've never signed a peace treaty with North Korea. He felt that the way he could preserve the integrity of the country was to have nuclear weapons. And he saw examples of places that didn't have them, which lost their integrity. A little later, there was Libya. One curious example, a little bit aside, but it's very strange, is that South Africa had them. The South Africans built 6 atomic bombs. They were never tested. They had a very clever way of producing enriched uranium. They made these 6 bombs. And just about the time when Mandela was released from prison, they gave them up. Now, I have talked to a man who has the odd name, Waldo Stumpf, who started out as a very young man in the program and later became his leader. And he claims absolutely it had nothing to do with the release of Mandela, and that it was just something that they did. But they did it. And it is the only example that I know of any country that has actually had nuclear weapons that has given them up. The Libyans gave up the program. Other people didn't start the program. But nobody else ever gave them up. Tom Lehrer has a song about proliferation, which I love. And
could you sing a few bars?
Yeah. Well, yes. South Africa wants 2. That's right. 1 for the black and 1 for the white. That's what his song. In the end, they got 6, and then they gave them up. And Tom was a friend of mine. When I pointed this out to him, said that he has to find a new lyric to describe the giving up of these things. So that's been sort of the history, that these countries, for their own security, feel they need them. And this has been true of North Korea from the beginning. And so the grandfather, first of all, he tried to get the Russians to give him some. The Russians were not prepared to give him any actual nuclear weapons. But what they did do is they gave him a reactor and they trained his people. So the early generation of North Korean scientists, as far as I know, were trained largely in Russia. the present generation has been trained in North Korea. There's a very interesting website I ran across, just kind of surfacing around the web, or surfing around the web. I ran across a website which showed what must be the MIT of North Korea. It was a very impressive looking place with hundreds of students, all of them identically dressed except for the ties, men and women, all wearing exactly the same outfits, except the ties were different. I suppose that indicated their classes. And they were celebrating a woman mathematician. And she was shown, and then a paper of hers was flashed on, which is in English, which she had co-authored with a well-known English mathematician about an important subject in mathematics. And then there was this thing that struck me of 100 students in a room, each one with their own computer, doing what they're doing. I suppose the North Koreans must make these computers. There's certainly a lot made in South Korea. There they all were. So they're making their own scientists. This, by the way, is also true of Iran. That's something I looked into in Iran. If you go to an Iranian institution, which you can find on the web, like the Institute in Tehran and so on, and you look at their physics faculty, which I do, first of all, I look at their courses. They had a marvelous course list. They wanted the philosophy of quantum mechanics. I was prepared to go to Tehran to take myself. It was marvelous. And then they had a nuclear physics program. They had four professors in this program. This is different from nuclear engineering. This must be the real scientific stuff. They had four people on the faculty. The senior one was trained in Edinburgh, and the other three were all trained in Iran. So they're all self-generating, these people. They don't need us for their scientists. They make their own. Now, so the North Koreans went after the trying to do a bomb very early. There are two materials you can use to make a nuclear explosion of a fission variety. And one of them is plutonium, and the other is what's called enriched uranium. To make plutonium, you need a reactor. So the North Koreans have about three or four now, and they produce quite a bit of plutonium. And it was also they have a program for enriching uranium. Enriching is a very bad term, but what it means is this: when uranium comes out of a mine, it is over 99% the isotope U-238. That's not a usable isotope for a weapon. So you have to extract less than 1% of U-235. U-235 is slightly lighter, so the only way you can do the separation is to make use of the mass difference. This is done in centrifuges, which fling out from the center the heavier isotope in small amounts. And by putting cascades of these centrifuges, you eventually can produce the 90% enrichment that you need. Now, the Iranians didn't have the Iranians too. And in fact, both the Iranians and the North Koreans have the same source for their centrifuge program, namely the Pakistani proliferator AQ Khan, who stole the plans for the centrifuges from his employment in Holland, came back to Pakistan, set up his program, and then set up a supermarket where he was selling these things to anybody who would buy them. He sold them to the Libyans. Gaddafi decided at some point to give it up, so he gave up what he bought from Khan. The CIA conveniently took it away, clued the plans of a nuclear weapon of a Chinese variety, so on, and also prototypes of the centrifuges. And AQ Khan, with the collusion of the Pakistani government, exchanged center information for rockets. And this exchange was carried out in Pakistani military aircraft. So there's no question it was done with the blessing of the Pakistan government. Now they have a centrifuge program. And we don't know in these devices that they've exploded which one they use. at least I don't know. Which brings up an interesting side question, which I've talked about, Cy. I have a coven of people I regard as great experts in these matters.
A coven is a group of witches, is it?
Witches. They're all these witches, my witch coven. They consist of two varieties. There are people like myself who may once have had a clearance, who don't have one now, and there are people who are still active in this stuff and have a clearance. Now, what happens is if I ask my coven a question like, are the North Koreans using uranium or plutonium? From my unclassified coven, I get an answer, I don't know. The classified coven, I get no answer at all, which suggests to me that they do know, but they're not telling me.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Kristen Kay. My guest today is Dr. Jeremy Bernstein, a retired theoretical physicist and former writer for The New Yorker. Dr. Bernstein, how concerned do you think Americans should be about this program in North Korea? If they have these weapons, will they use them?
Well, those are two different questions. I think we should be terribly concerned. The last test that the North Koreans made, they produced an explosion which was at least 5 to 10 times more powerful the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima. Also, presumably the technique they're using, they can make it light enough so it'll fit into one of their rockets. We also know they've been testing intercontinental ballistic missiles. So they will have, at some point, if this is not stopped, intercontinental ballistic missiles which will have nuclear warheads. So how can you not be concerned? And so other question as to how to stop them. I think that the military option is really not terribly viable. And at this point, I don't know what we can offer them. I mean, Kim Il-sung has made it very clear that he must have nuclear weapons to preserve his regime. So what do you offer a person? You say, well, forget about it. We'll help you preserve your. You know, he doesn't trust it. Doesn't believe us. So I don't see what the outcome of this is going to be. I hope it's not going to be a military confrontation because nobody will win. We'll destroy North Korea. They'll destroy South Korea, and there it'll be.
Mm-hmm. So the lifting of sanctions wouldn't be a motivator for Kim Jong-un.
Well, so far not. Mm-hmm. They do stuff on the black market. I just read this morning that they were trying to do things in Bitcoin. They're trying to hack into Bitcoin and so on. And they do a lot of business in China, and they're still doing a lot of business in China. So I don't know whether the sanctions will help. It's better than nothing. Maybe it would help if a high-level diplomatic mission went over to see them. So far, we don't even have a diplomatic representative in South Korea now. So maybe that would help. I just don't know.
Do you think there's any possible solution in the area of missile defense, that is, shooting down their missiles?
Well, we can shoot some of them down. I don't know how reliable this defense is. I think you can shoot some of them down, but if they send up a bunch, some of which are decoys. Mm. It's not clear that how well this works. But if they shoot one over Japan again, it would seem to me a reasonable thing for the Japanese to shoot it down, show we're serious about this. So I don't know.
Dr. Bernstein, what's the difference between a hydrogen bomb and an atomic bomb?
Yike. Well,
explain this to me.
You asked the right guy.
Well, first of all, let me say that all nuclear weapons make use of Einstein's equation E equal MC squared. But what's called a hydrogen bomb, what's called a fission bomb, make use of it in different ways. Let's start with a fission bomb because that may be a little more straightforward to explain. And I want to point out that no weapon can function without a fission primary. So if you stop a country from making a fission bomb, you stop the program, period. There's no such thing as a hydrogen bomb without a fission bomb. So what is a fission bomb? Well, a fission bomb uses as its fissile material uranium or plutonium, which are very heavy elements. If you split them by hitting them with a neutron and splitting them, what you do is you split them into elements which have a lighter mass. For example, the first fission ever observed, which was done in 1938 by Otto Hahn and Strassmann, was the fission of uranium into barium and krypton. If you add up the masses of barium and krypton, it's less than the uranium mass. That mass difference is available for energy with Einstein's equation. So that's the source of the energy in the fission bomb. Fusion bomb works at the complete other end of the spectrum. It works on isotopes of hydrogen. You have ordinary hydrogen, which has a nucleus one proton. You have heavy hydrogen, which is called the deuteron, the subject of my beloved thesis. That has one proton and one neutron. Then you have super heavy hydrogen, has two neutrons and one proton. Now, if you provide a suitable atmosphere, and the only way to provide the atmosphere is using a fission explosion, you can cause these light isotopes to fuse. So the fusion that is relevant for the hydrogen bomb is the fusion of tritium plus deuteron, which produces helium plus a very energetic neutron. So that's what happens. So in a fission bomb, you make use of fission. You take some kilograms of enriched uranium. You set it off by discharging neutrons, and it sets a chain reaction off. In a hydrogen bomb, you use a fission primary to produce that temperature and pressure required to cause the fusion. Then the fusion takes place. It produces these very energetic neutrons, which can in turn cause additional fission. So the energy regimes of the yields of these two weapons are quite different, although it gets a little tricky because there's a crossover, which is called a boosted weapon, which I think is what the North Koreans did explode, which makes use of both, has a fission primary, a fusion secondary produces neutrons, which cause additional fission. So this is called a boosted fission weapon. Now, the yield is measured in tons of TNT. And the very useful way of thinking about this is to think about the explosion that Timothy McVeigh did in what, Kansas City, was it?
Oklahoma.
He rented a Ryder truck, and he had 5,000 pounds, 2.5 tons, of a high explosive. I don't think it was TNT. But keep in mind the 2.5 tons. That's what he had. That was enough to knock down the Murrah building. The useful unit for measuring the yield of nuclear weapons is kilotons, 1,000 tons, as opposed to the 2.5 tons. So in those units, the Hiroshima bomb was 15 kilotons. Nagasaki was about 20 kilotons. A hydrogen bomb is in the million kiloton range. And what the North Koreans shot off was 100 kilotons. Hmm. So we do not know whether that was a specially engineered hydrogen bomb, which produces 100 kilotons, which the modern hydrogen bombs do. Our hydrogen bombs that we deploy in our rockets, and which the British, for that matter, deploy in their Trident missiles, are 100 kiloton bombs. We no longer use these monsters. So we don't know in the case of the North Koreans whether they have tested a boosted weapon or real hydrogen. We don't know. Either way, it's not good. Because in either case, you can miniaturize them. You can miniaturize them because you replace the very heavy uranium and plutonium by the lighter hydrogen. So you can reduce the mass dramatically of the thing and get it to fit into rockets. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know whether somebody knows whether it was a boosted weapon or whether it was a hydrogen bomb. I asked my coven. Mm-hmm. And my non-clearance member, which is David Albright, who has this wonderful site for these things, former weapons inspector, says he didn't know. My coven people said nothing, which makes you believe they do know, but they're not talking.
No news might be bad news.
Well, no news might mean you don't have a clearance, you're not going to get any news, you don't need to know.
Right. That was Dr. Jeremy Bernstein, a retired theoretical physicist and former writer for The New Yorker. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Kristen Kay. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. Shift gears just a little bit. I think there might be an unfair stereotype about scientists not being able to communicate or being dry, but you are actually a prolific writer. You write with a lot of humor and a lot of clarity. You wrote for The New Yorker for a number of years. What has it been like for you to have one foot in the scientific community and then one foot in the literary world?
Well, it's been a mixed bag amongst my colleagues, I would say my writing was both admired and resented. Being a member of the staff of The New Yorker led to a lot of privileges. I met a lot of people, did a lot of things. I made some amazing trips. I made trips to Nepal and Tibet on The New Yorker's dime and so on, which I couldn't imagine doing just being a physicist. Also, I did less physics. There's only so many hours in a day. So I did less physics. I don't think if I had done more physics, I would have been a Freeman Dyson or a Murray Gell-Mann or anything like that. But I would have done more physics, which I didn't do. I have no regrets about this. I've been very, very happy with this split.
And then you've won awards for your writing on science and actually on some of your writing on being in the mountains. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So I'm also curious about that. Is there a connection there between like your appreciation for nature and what drives you to be a physicist?
Well, I don't really have any appreciation for nature.
Spoken like a true New Yorker.
As far as I'm concerned, as long as nature minds its business and nothing stings or bites me, I'll mind mine. No, the mountain climbing thing was quite different. I got interested in mountain climbing when I was really a very small kid, partly because my father one summer took us to the Adirondacks, and I climbed, which really, I was about 7 or 8, so I didn't really climb anything, but I hiked a lot. And then he gave me a book called High Conquest by James Ramsey Ullman, which described mountains climbed and not climbed. When the book was written, Everest had not been climbed. And I made this lunatic ambition, which was to see the 10 highest mountains in the world. Hmm. I had this ambition. I was pretty sure I was not going to climb any of them, but I thought I could at least see them. And by God, I did, every one of them, by the time I stopped. But as far as the physics is concerned, I began going to CERN in Geneva. And if you're in Geneva, you know, you look at the Mont Blanc. And I tell you, if you have any love of the mountains, it's a lure. So I started going to Chamonix, which is at the foot of the Mont Blanc. And I started hiking. And I thought, I took one look at the aiguille, the needles of Chamonix. I said, oh God, you know, this is some other animal that climbs these things, not for me. So I spent, I remember a summer doing all the hikes. The other summer I said, yeah, well, I'll just go to the guide bureau and I'll plead my case. I went to the guide bureau and I said, look, I'm incompetent. I'm terrified and I'm incompetent. And nobody will want to go out with me. So no, you're just the sort of person we're looking for. So I got a young guy named Henri Dufour, very, very amusing character. And he took me on to practice rock. And I did well enough. So the next day I climbed a small aiguille. And then that was it. I got hooked. Then the next summer I came back to CERN. I said, well, I'm going to do this again. But Dufour had hurt himself in a skiing accident. And by a complete freak, I fell upon the exact guy that I wanted, a guy called Claude Jacou, who was a great climber and an intellectual and so on. And we became enormously good friends. We traveled to Nepal and Tibet, and we did all kinds of climbs all over the Alps. We became very, very close friends. And after I'd climbed with him for a couple of summers, I thought to myself, you know, these Chamonix guides really have an interesting history. And they're interesting people. They're trained an interesting way, and they have this profession in which they risk their lives. You know, a couple of guys are killed every summer anyway. I thought, well, I was then writing for The New Yorker. I said, well, you know, I think I could write about this. So I wrote what turned out to be a three-part article called On the Invention of Mountain Climbing and Its Practice, in which I described the first climbs of the Mont Blanc, the Matterhorn. Then I had a part having to do with Jacou and his life. And it was very well received.
Well, Dr. Bernstein, Cy Coleman, thank you so much for joining me today in the studio.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cross Currents. I'm Kristen Kay. Thanks to my guest today, Dr. Jeremy Bernstein, a retired theoretical physicist, science essayist, and former writer for The New Yorker. He's also an honorary member of the Board of Trustees for the Aspen Center for Physics. Aspen Public Radio founder and former station manager Cy Coleman joined us in the studio. This is Cross Currents on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Kristen Kay. If you missed today's show, you can go to our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Cross Currents is a production of Aspen Public Radio.